Well, Madiz, we may be vaguely familiar with the literary and artistic outpourings of Ed Ward in England and the Belle Epoque in Paris, but I don't think we know a lot about what was happening with German culture at the end of the 19th century. The commonly held image of Germany at the time was of Kaiser Wilhelm strutting around in military garb. He was absolutely besotted with uniforms, had hundreds of them, complete with spiked helmets and his handlebar moustache, preaching a rampant nationalism to the masses. But beneath the surface of 1890s German militarism, you find fascinating subcultures filled with progressive thinkers, experimental writers, bohemian countesses, one in particular will take your breath away, and even the world's first gay rights activist. Now, we know this because of the aforementioned Australian James Conway, who's been researching the subculture of Wilhelmine era for years, and he's set up Rixdorf Editions, which is a brave independent publishing house in Berlin. Books he produces are exquisite, to revive the forgotten texts on and publish them in English for the first time. And yes, he's unearthed some absolute gems. James joins us now via Skype from Berlin. Welcome, James.
Hello, Philip. A pleasure to talk to you.
How did someone from Sydney end up discovering these late 19th century subcultures that even German scholars wouldn't be aware of?
It's an odd one. It's if it is known at all, it's generally within academic circles, that the writers that I deal with generally aren't found on your average German bookshelf or in bookstores, at most in libraries. Yes, it's an odd one, and I think there's a certain advantage to being an outsider, and this really came to mind recently when I went to an event here in Berlin at the Australian Embassy, and it was to mark the anniversary of the Australian Book Review, and Anna Funda was one of the speakers, the author of the wonderful book Stasiland, and she was dealing with a later period in German history, in about East Germany and about talking to the perpetrators and the victims of state oppression at the time.
We know the author and the book very well.
Yeah, and she talked about how it seemed odd at the time that this woman would come from literally the other side of the world and she would engage so intensely with this period of German history. But she said there's a real advantage to that, that you come as a kind of naive and you can ask questions that perhaps a German couldn't ask. You don't really have skin in the game, and it gives you a bit of freedom to explore things in a different way.
We're looking at a time when, Bismarck has resigned, and Kaiser Wilhelm is strutting the stage. What is it, 1890 to 1918? What was it like living in Germany at that time?
Yeah, so it's called Wilhelmine Germany. The term itself doesn't have a lot of recognition even now, and it's a little confusing because there were actually two Wilhelms, and it was Wilhelm I who united Germany, and Wilhelm II is our guy. And yes, so we're looking at the last decade of the 19th century and up until the end of the First World War in 1918. It was a time of enormous upheaval. So there was... you mentioned earlier about Wilhelm and his passion for the military and his quest for military power, and all that was happening. But at the same time, it was large-scale industrialization, and with that, urbanization. And so you had these forces coming together in cities, and you had this sort of questioning of everything. And you read Nietzsche, who was still alive at the time, but unfortunately out to pasture, in a mental sense, but he talked about the reevaluation of all values, and he was kind of advocating this, but this is what was happening anyway. People were really questioning where they'd come from and what kind of society they wanted.
We'll get onto the questioning in a minute, but I want to share with the listener a little bit on the Kaiser. I like the fact that he cultivated a special severe facial expression for public occasions and photographs. And there are many that he would send. Well, he'd send out signed photos and portrait busts to anyone who asked for them. What a strutting, pompous ass.
Yeah, there's a real cult of personality. And there was an interesting article not long after Donald Trump came to power in the Washington Post, and it said, and this is the time when people were throwing out comparisons to the third right quite freely, and this article said, yes, Donald Trump reminds us of a German leader, but it's not the one you're thinking of. And they drew this comparison with Wilhelm II. He was very arrogant. He had problematic relations with the media. He thought he could more or less rule on his own. He didn't need advisors. And so it gives you a pretty vivid sense of who he was.
So what we're looking at is an ostensibly authoritarian, rigidly conservative society, a bit like the popular view of Victorian England, but a lot of things were going on beneath the surface.
Exactly, and like Victorian England, there was this sort of top-down hierarchy, starting with the monarch, but there were so many things happening underneath, and you think of the 1890s in Britain, Oscar Wilde and his associates, and that incredibly rich culture then. And yes, that was happening in Germany at the same time. So in the when these forces came together, when people started meeting in cities, in Berlin and Munich and other places, just the sheer proximity and the intensity of the contact in the cafes and the taverns, it really led to this vital exchange. And you know, we have to remember that the First World War hadn't happened, and a certain level of optimism was allowed. You could imagine a better world, and of course, they didn't know the catastrophe to come.
I was aware that Munich was an interesting place, but you describe it as being as holding its own with Montmartre, Chelsea, Greenwich Village.
Yeah, and that was a real surprise in my research that we know about Berlin in the Weimar era and what a vital centre that was. But before the First World War, it was really Munich that had the edge. It had long been a place of culture. It's full of museums, and Ludwig II, the King of Bavaria, was famously a patron of Wagner's. And so it had been a fairly enlightened place. And then when you had these ambitious people coming to the city and sharing their ideas, it became this slightly more subversive place where you could dream of a new society and find people who would, respond to your vision.
Well, let's have a look at some of these people. You launched your publishing house with two books, the first of which, I have to say, has the most intriguing title, The Guest House at the Sign of the Teetering Globe. And you say it was written by a Bohemian countess, whom you describe as possibly the most liberated woman of her era. Later this week, I'll be interviewing Germaine Greer, so I think that even Germaine would acknowledge the Countess was remarkable.
She was remarkable. So this is Franziska zu Reventlow, and she was called the Bohemian Countess, which was a very apt title. She was, in fact, born a countess. I found images of her before I even read about her life, and there's something about her, there's this real candor and directness to them that I really responded to, and something suggested that's an interesting life. And then I read, and of course it was, and there's easily a movie or two in her life. So she was born into this aristocratic family, and everything suggested that she would just marry a fellow aristocrat and live a life of nothing in particular in glamorous surroundings. But she had this spark within her, this rebellious spark, and then it really ignited in around 1890, when she got in contact with writers at the time, and I heard you mentioning Tolstoy earlier, and people like Henrik Ibsen, who, it's a little hard to imagine now, but they were real rebels, and Nietzsche, and that really fired her imagination. And so she said, "Sod this, I'm going to Munich, and I'm going to live this very bohemian life." And what she was after more than anything was freedom, freedom from any constraints. And so she took lovers. She had an illegitimate child and refused to divulge the father's name. She travelled around Europe as an independent woman traveller, which is extremely rare at the time.
Let me share a couple of quotes with the listener. She said, "I can only love, but I can never belong to another. I love one and desire six others, one after the other. It's only change and the gentleman stranger that stimulate me. Good on her."
She was claiming the sexual liberty that men at the time, particularly in bohemian circles, were claiming for themselves. And she, you know, wasn't a woman to stand for double standards. She said, if it's okay for the gander, it's okay for the goose. I've got that the right way around. You know what I mean? That if a man can do that, if, you know, you have this sort of slightly heroic figure of the roué and the rake, and that's kind of an appealing thing, she was like, well, I can do that too. And she did.
I believe her behaviour was so outrageous that the aforementioned aristocratic family disowned her.
That's true. And she did run away from them, but she hoped to maintain contact with them. So this was a source of anguish. And she was, for example, barred from her father's deathbed. And her brother Ernst was pretty much the complete polar opposite to her. He was reactionary, very far right. Later threw his lot in with the Nazis, unsurprisingly. And Franziska herself was apolitical but a pacifist. And Ernst came to Munich and gave a lecture on war and what a good thing war was and why we should have a war. And this is about 1908 or so. And she was so appalled by this, and most of the audience was as well. This was so out of keeping at the time. And they fell out. And, yes, she... didn't have contact with their family.
Talking to James Conway. She wrote an essay, an article in 1897 called The Last Judgment, which was banned on the grounds of blasphemy. Did you locate the essay?
I have. I've read it. I haven't translated it. It's quite, if I remember correctly, it's a while since I read it, but she has the figure of Christ in it. And at the time, you know, people were going to jail for blasphemy, so this was already quite a big deal. And if I remember correctly, he had a very strong Berlin accent. I'm not sure what she was trying to suggest with that, but yeah, that was... She always pushed the envelope, and that's an example. And she used her own life in her writing as well. And she didn't spare herself. She had no sense of self-pity, but a great sense of irony, and nor her predicament. She never sort of wallowed in her sadness. She just used it for her art. And
well, she burnt her candle at both ends, and dies young.
She did. She died in 1918. So we've just had the 100th anniversary of her. Of her death here, and the Radio National equivalent ran a very long piece overnight about her. So it's a bit of belated acknowledgement of her, but it seems like people in Germany are becoming more aware of her.
Okay, let's move on to Magnus Hirschfeld. The second translation you've published is a book called Berlin's Third Sex, and Hirschfeld is astonishing.
He is. He's probably of the authors I've translated. He's probably the best known. He's had works translated in English already, but not this book, Berlin's Third Sex. And it was a real puzzle to me because it was so compelling and was such an amazing document of his time to really explore. He was exploring gay and lesbian Berlin, this very rich subculture at the beginning of the early 20th century, and I thought I was fairly well-versed in German cultural history. I had no idea. And so it was a real revelation to me.
Tell us the circumstances which led him to write a pamphlet calling for the decriminalisation of gay sex, which, of course, was then outlawed under the German penal code.
It was. So when the German Empire formed in 1871, they basically adopted mostly Prussian legislation, and what the piece of legislation that Hirschfeld was particularly exercised by was paragraph 175, and that specifically outlawed sex between males. Sex between females, apparently, they didn't even think was a thing. But as well as sex between males, it also mentioned sex with animals. So that's the kind of level that they thought, you know, gay men were at.
Well, you describe a scene at a medical school where he's traumatized by a lecture on sexual degeneracy, and a gay man who'd been incarcerated in an asylum for 30 years because of his homosexuality was paraded naked before the students like a laboratory animal.
Right, and this isn't much more advanced from, you know, laughing at the inmates at Bedlam and things like that, and also people coming to him with their terrible tales of being rejected by their families and hearing about people who had committed suicide really fired him up to address this legislation, and it was the cause of his life, and sadly he never saw it repealed. And in fact, in the Nazis strengthened the law and made it even more onerous, and he was in exile by that time. But that's when it really became critical for especially gay men in Germany.
We should point out that this is happening at a time when Oscar Wilde is being tormented in England, and Hirschfeld launches the world's first gay rights organisation. Now, whereas Wilde lamented the persecution of people, Hirschfeld organised to fight for justice.
That's right. So this is 1897, and in Berlin, he actually set up the committee in his apartment. And the aim of the committee was to give legitimacy to this cause, this very new cause. It was the very first gay rights group in history. And also to research different facets of gender and sexual identity in what even now strikes me as a very modern way. He goes back and forth. The terminology is all over the place. It's not fixed. He contradicts himself, but you know, that's Twitter now. You could see these conversations playing out right now.
You also point out that Berlin was, despite the kick the Kaiser, a relatively tolerant place, and the city's chief of criminal police monitored the population but didn't rigorously enforce the law against homosexuality. But it seems that Hirschfeld would actually take the police commissioner on tours of the city's gay bars.
That's right, and this is a chap called Leopold von Merscheid-Hülesheim. It's quite a mouthful. And he was really critical to what Hirschfeld was writing about in Berlin's Third Sex. It was because of his policies that this subculture thrived, and his policy was essentially to contain it but not to confront people. So he kept it under control. He monitored gay bars and taverns and cafes and so on, but there were very few raids. And and he would take people, he'd take visitors on tours of these places. So it was relatively open. It was, you know, it was a time when there was censorship. You could go to jail for saying the wrong thing. But I think Berlin's Third Sex is an amazing example of what actually passed through the net at that time.
There's a marvellous story here. Hirschfeld becomes famous. His notoriety spreads worldwide. And when told, American newspapers were hailing him as the Einstein of sex, he wittily replied that he would feel much happier if they called Einstein the Hirschfeld of physics. So he also had a very good sense of humour.
He did, yeah. And I think he was, he allowed himself a self-deprecatory joke on that occasion. He was quite a modest man in other ways. He was, if you read his autobiography, he didn't really say much about himself, partly because he was gay. It wasn't just purely scientific interest. He was exploring his own identity, but you'll find very little about that in his autobiography.
Unfortunately, we don't have time to go into the gory details of what happens under the Nazis, but it's a tragic end to a very courageous story. What do you think we can gain from reading books like Berlin's Third Sex 100 years on?
What I hope is that in this very small, modest project that I have, that I can show that there's this incredibly rich progressive heritage. And when you think of what's happening in Chemnitz at the moment and the face that Germany is presenting to the world, and this is frankly appalling to me, and I would really like to show, again, in this very modest way, look, this is not Germany. This is not the Germany I know. And in fact, its progressive roots are even older and worth exploring. And I think in times like this where, you know, progressive values are under threat, it's a good idea to go back and reaffirm them by exploring their roots.
Well, you're doing your best with Rixdorf's editions, and I congratulate you. As a matter of fact, you're about to get an award. I haven't given out a koala stamp for a while. You're now the proud owner of a koala stamp, the highest honour that our little radio program can bestow, and it's when people work beyond and above the call of duty, and you're certainly, certainly doing that. James Conway.
Truly honoured. Thank you.
James, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll put a link to James' publishing house, Rixdorf Editions, on our website for those of you who wish to delve deeper into the radical texts that we've been discussing.